Okay, so how does a stand-up comic, Dan Tomasulo, hailed by the legendary improv as one of the four top comics, alongside people like Robin Williams and Andy Kaufman, end up leaving it all behind to pursue a PhD in psychology and MFA in writing, a Master of Applied Positive Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, then build a decades-long career in clinical practice, land a gig as the incoming academic director and core faculty member at the Spirituality Mind-Body Institute at Columbia University, and become a leading voice in the world of positive psychology, positive education, psychodrama, and positive psychotherapy? And how exactly along the way does that same person build a career as a writer, penning an award-winning memoir, American Snake Pit, along with a companion screenplay that has since racked up awards at more than 30 film festivals, all while deepening into teaching, researching, helping thousands, and now bringing to the world a new book, Learned Hopefulness, The Power of Positivity to Overcome Depression, at a time that we need these ideas more than ever. How does one person do all of this? And what is this thing he calls learned hopefulness? This is where we go in today's conversation. So excited to share it with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that your loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss.
So I was a comic. I was a stand-up comic for years. And if you go back and look on the 20th anniversary of the Improv, they picked four top comics at the time. You know, it was Robin Williams. We had Andy Kaufman. We had, you know, it was all like that. And then four of us who were up-and-comers. And I was one of those guys. The other three have gone on to marvelous careers. And I have decided to blend a little bit of comedy with the real world. And during that time, I was writing, but I was also finishing my PhD in psychology. So I was writing comedy. You know, it takes about an hour to write a minute of comedy. You have lots of bad jokes that don't seem to make it. And then performing, you know, pretty much every night, and then on the circuit a bit. And so what happened was this tear came. And the tear was sort of like, geez, you know, to finish a PhD and then to be 4 a.m. in Hell's Kitchen doing comedy to a bunch of other comics, something had to give. And what gave was I got introduced to psychodrama, and that was back in 1980. And that just blew me away. It was like, oh, wait, I don't have to sacrifice, you know, what I love about performance and comedy and writing for psychology and vice versa. And so I was probably a little, you know, I thought I would learn everything there is to know about psychodrama in about a year, but it took me 13 years postdoc to learn all that. And then that was very powerful. That opened me up to like the possibility of deeply exploring healing, the use of humor during therapeutic encounters. I ended up becoming a trauma expert and then a positive psychology. And I think the humor has informed it. And then somewhere along the line, I became more serious about writing, because writing jokes takes, you know, a certain skill, but writing a 1,500-word essay is something a little more. And then I went back to the New School to get an MFA in writing, because academic writing will destroy your brain. So I had to go back and get a little creative.
Yeah, I, it's funny. I have writing to me is still my first expressive medium. I went to law school and did a stint as a lawyer and was taught this very rigid formulaic way of writing. And when I finally transitioned out of that, and I felt well informed, and I really appreciated the structure and the thought process, but I was so excited to actually be able to step into a different way to write and freestyle and storytell. I'm curious about psychodrama, because I don't entirely understand what it is. Can you share a bit more about that?
Sure. Well, just a little historical perspective. So back in Vienna at the time of Freud, there was Jacob Levy Moreno. And there's, you know, Freud was trying to recruit people into his new movement on psychoanalysis. So Jung was part of that from Zurich, you know, and they tried to enlist Moreno, as Moreno was developing this, you know, really theater-based approach to healing. And there's a famous encounter between Freud and Moreno where Freud tries to get him over, you know, to the psychoanalytic side. And what Moreno says, "You put people on a couch and analyze their dreams. I put them on a stage and teach them to dream again." I think that was the last time they talked, you know. So, but just, you know, importantly, Moreno went on to be called the psychiatrist of the century in the same century as Freud, just to let you know his impact. He developed social network theory, which is what Facebook is based on. And really all forms of group therapy emanated from psychodrama. And it's an action-oriented form of therapy. So if you say you're upset with your mother in regular therapy, then we talk about it for an hour. But in psychodrama, we'd put an empty chair and invite your mother into the room. And what happens during that kind of an encounter is that you're activating memory in a different way, and you're activating the possibility for transformation in a different way, because it's what's called embodied cognition. It basically means when I play a role, and I play that role as deeply as possible, my brain changes. So what I became fascinated with is the idea that psychodrama can move very quickly, and we can see healing things, if it's done right, in the same speed of time that you can see trauma happen. And so I applied it to people who've been traumatized, who had great difficulty to get some relief sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. I know I'm familiar with like one of the modalities that's been talked about a number of times over the years in adipositive psychology, the gratitude visit.
Yeah.
But I know you have an interesting variation, which until now I didn't realize, I guess, is steeped in sort of like the overlay between positive psychology then and psychodrama, which sort of like takes that same empty chair approach.
Yeah. Well, man, you've done your homework. I'm impressed. When I went through a really rough time about 10 years ago, and nothing really worse than a depressed psychologist. You know, people would talk to me about their depression, and I'd be like, huh, you think you got it bad? You know, I didn't actually say that. But, you know, I was in therapy and supervision. And then a friend of mine said, why don't you go see what Marty Seligman is doing over at UPenn? And I went, and when I got there, it was like, oh my goodness. I was originally trained as a researcher, and I was like, man, if even a half of what they're doing is true, we've really got something. And I signed up for, the master's program. I didn't really need any of the academic degrees, but I figured, I know me, if I'm not committed to something, I just won't get it, you know? And I went and, saw Marty's work. And, you know, that was a big thing to study this gratitude visit where students would write a letter of gratitude and then actually deliver them. And I remember like literally the first day saying to Marty, that's a great start, but what if the people you have gratitude for aren't available anymore? They've passed on. You've lost track of them. We have this rich resource of gratitude that could be harvested if we did it in a psychodramatic way. So I started to experiment with that. Most of psychodrama was about unveiling and releasing negative emotions. And so most people have heard of that as a catharsis. But when you go back and look at what Aristotle said, there was two kinds of catharsis. We never talk about the other one. There was a catharsis of abreaction, which is basically a purging of negative emotions. But then there was this catharsis of integration. And integration basically is what happens when we have a positive emotion. When there's something really good that's going on, we want to find ways to bring it in and hang on to it. We don't want to purge that. So I developed this technique called the virtual gratitude visit. And basically what happens is that people will put an empty chair across from themselves, and they'll identify who it is that they want to express gratitude toward. And then they find the words that go with that. And it's extraordinary to watch. I've probably done 500 of these now. We do research on this sort of stuff. It's very powerful. And then what happens is they reverse roles and become the other person. See, that's the part in positive psychology that hasn't really been fully embraced. And that's where I do a lot of my work. When you reverse roles, this embodied cognition allows you to receive the gratitude that you were sending. That is where the catharsis of integration happens. And then they come back to their own role and close it out. Can I just tell a quick story on this?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So Dan Lerner and Alan Schlechter have this great course at NYU. And every semester I'm invited to do a virtual gratitude visit. It's usually around Thanksgiving in the fall and right after spring break in the spring. And every year, it's 500 students, so it's an amphitheater. And I've had a lot of training in psychodrama, so I know how to set it up, get them ready, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then we pick a volunteer comes up, and inevitably, every semester for the last, I don't know, 10 years or how long the course is running, all the students and the people on stage, they're crying once they do this thing. And I guess it was the last time I was there, someone had gotten special permission to come into the class and they wanted to see me do this thing. So the guy came in a little bit late and I was already right in the middle of this drama. And he opened the door and every single person is crying. And I could hear him because you could, you know, hear a pin drop. He goes, oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was positive psychology. And they're going, yes, it is. You know, so that's a catharsis of integration. That's the way that stuff works.
Yeah. I mean, so powerful. I haven't done this yet, but I actually want to do it. I'm going to spend some time trying to think about it. And also it's such, I love that what you've taken a tool that was sort of like out there and explored, and but there was this really one substantial blind spot, which is what if this person, either through passing on or through geography or through just, you know, the complication of communication, is not available to you to actually, you know, like be with, you know, the traditional approach to the gratitude visit where you actually have them and you're like sharing your gratitude, you lose all of that potential to gain that same experience. And then the addition of being able to feel the integration side by switching roles, so powerful. Yeah. And it makes so much sense. But I think that's what sometimes happens, right? With different modalities, when you're sort of, you know, we tend to exist in silos to a certain extent, and we go narrow and deep into our field of expertise. Right. And then when we have somebody who can sort of come into our orbit and say, well, this is fascinating, and I have expertise in this different but complementary thing, of what happens if you couple the two together.
Yeah, I think that's partly what has happened in the fusion of my different backgrounds and skills. Is like, okay, so can we do this with writing? Can we do this with psychodrama? Can we take the best of what we know can happen with people and use it as an exemplar, or create an experience where people aren't just learning about gratitude like, you know, the charts and diagrams, but can they feel the transformation? You know, the clinical division of the International Positive Psychology Association has been very supportive and very kind when they've seen this work. And that's been very helpful as well, because along the way, I had won a couple of awards for doing something new, an Innovators Award and that kind of thing. And what I like about it is that, you know, a lot of people who are doing the research are giving us some incredible data. And I sort of see my role now is, how can I make this come alive? How can we take this and make it simple, accessible, powerful, so that people have that capacity? Last year, by the way, in Australia, I did the flip side of the virtual gratitude visit. I don't know if it's quite the flip, but it was the embodied cognition version of self-compassion, because this is with another person, the virtual gratitude visit. But with self-compassion, you actually have an encounter with your benevolent self, that aspect of you, that part of you that would treat you like a good friend. And again, I just took the work that was there, Christine Neff's work on compassion, just beautiful work, but it really didn't include the use of a role reversal. Even some of her work had an empty chair kind of tucked in there, but it's the role reversal where you play both sides. And then what happens is you come back to your space more whole. And that's really something to watch too. You see people kind of do a 3 to 5 minute role play, and when they're done, they're whole. And that's cool to watch.
Yeah, and don't we need more of that these days?
True enough.
I'm curious about the writing also. You mentioned you eventually went back and you got your MFA. That was at the New School. And I believe you also either were taught by or mentored by somebody who's an old friend of mine and a friend of the show, Danny Shapiro.
Oh, yeah, sure. Danny, she was my, she was extraordinary and my mentor at the New School. Very, very wonderful woman.
Yeah. So part of my fascination is that the choice to go back and get an MFA in writing, I mean, granted, you have a lot of degrees now, you know, that's not, I understand the desire to learn how to work with words to help out with sort of, you know, like the therapeutic outcomes and develop better protocols and modalities. But this to me also, it sounds like there is also this standalone thing with you, which is just a joy, a love of writing, a love of creative expression, a love of storytelling, because, you know, it shows up not just, you know, the fact that you've, you know, penned memoirs, but also books and playwriting and screenwriting. And so this is independent of its sort of utility in, you know, helping figure out how to get people better outcomes. It sounds like it is a true creative channel for you as well.
Yeah. My father wanted me to go into the electrical union when I was a teenager, because I really wasn't college material, you know. And so I failed the test to go into the electricians union. So we had friends, and they tried to get me into the carpenters union, the tin knockers union. And I remember taking the test for the plumbers union, where they escorted me out of the building. They said, you know, this young man should be allowed to flush a toilet by himself, but if he has to fill a tub, there should be assistance, you know. So I didn't really have any other skills, and I went to college on a little wrestling thing, which didn't last very long. But I remember taking the creative writing course, and I was like, they teach courses in this, telling stories, this is awesome, you know. And I didn't realize the power of it. I knew that writing was something that was inside of me, and you know, wanting to communicate stories. But there's a big difference between telling a story verbally and writing a story and then communicating a tale. These are just different skill sets. And I knew I had some ability with that, but I was also very much aware of some of my favorite writers. You know, you look at David Sedaris, and it's like, oh my goodness, you know. And even people, crossover folks like Oliver Sacks or Irvin Yalom, when you see that you can have people who are deeply informed at one level who can tell stories for transformation, that just ignited me. And I went to a new school. I'm glad I went when I did. I think I went in the first year they had opened. I don't think I could get in now, tell you the truth. It's so evolved. But I went in, and I'll tell you, the training there was extraordinary. And after the first year, I was kind of like known as, oh, it's the psychologist guy who tells jokes. And so it was, you know, and then I got to Lucy Greeley's class, Anatomy of a Face. You know, we had to take memoir classes, and Danny's class and memoir. And Lucy said, you're not going to pass my course unless you write the darkest thing you've ever written. And I said, then I'm not going to pass your course. I don't really need the degree. I don't care about the course. We had a little back and forth. And she was like, well, it's okay with me. It's just like, you already know how to write something funny, but I don't think you've had enough experience writing about something dark. So she challenged me, and I told her, okay, you want dark? I live all day in dark. I'll I'll do that. So for this whole semester, I wrote one story. And this story was about the night my cousin died of an overdose of heroin. And this story had no landing gear. It goes from that moment where we're having about as much fun as you can have, having dinner, and then he goes home, shoots up, dies, and the next morning I'm at his wake. And my life, I was in that PhD program. I was doing comedy. I was doing all that. And so I wrote that story. And I said, there you go, Lucy, you want dark? You got dark. And she submitted that for the university prize, and it won. He worked at a bar called Kettle of Fish, a famous dive bar in New York City. And that was the title of the story. And that's what got me an agent and got me this and that. And, you know, and so Danny Shapiro was just an extraordinary person, because she was on the other side of that. You know, she was helping me like think things through more thoroughly, more deeply, using different elements of story to make a point. And so, yeah, it could be funny, but it doesn't matter after a while unless you have a punctuation point. And so my first memoir, Confessions of a Former Child, included that story about my cousin. And everybody, when they read that book, appreciated the comedy, but it was the balance of the pathos that that gave it the richness. So I can't say enough good things about the new school or Danny Shapiro.
Yeah, and what I mean, to be able to work with both Lucy and Danny sort of like at the same time, I mean, two legends in this space with just so... such deep wisdom, so much to share. It must have been so impactful.
Yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose. And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi's starter pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash, and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you.
It's so interesting also that the idea of you being able to tell, you know, like that particular story and being wired for comedy. Like one of the things that popped into my mind as you were just sharing that was Hannah Gadsby's performance, not the recent one, Douglas, the one before it. I'm just now blanking on what the name was, where she goes from making people, you know, like really laugh, then to going to a very painful, dark experience that was absolutely extraordinary, that left people in tears. And maybe they showed up thinking that they were, you know, going to a comedy show. But to the one, you know, like people who I've known who have seen that have been just profoundly moved and been thankful for the experience. And I think there's such an interesting line, and it's so thin between those two extremes, you know, like the extreme darkness and just pure humor, and dancing between those in a way which is cathartic and integrative, right? To go back to what we were talking about, I think what a powerful skill set to be able to develop.
I remember being so fascinated with George Carlin, from my era, my time, you start looking at people like Carlin and all the way back, Lenny Bruce. And here are people who breached all kinds of boundaries by using the skill set of being able to tell a story that would make you laugh so hard you could barely catch your breath, and then, take a transition or a bridge comment and take you all the way back to see something so uncomfortable. And I was a George Carlin freak, and he passed away before his book had been finished, which was a memoir. His brother actually reads it, and his brother sounds very much like him. But part of the interview and part of the material that he had, he talked about the fact that as he matured as a comic, he learned to put people into very, very, very uncomfortable places, and then give them a release. And that the comedy ended up being a way to sort of pulsate the emotions, which I think has tremendous value, because he could talk about abortion or problems in the church. He could talk about all this stuff and make people almost cringe, and then tell this ridiculous story or this anecdote that was just hysterical. I don't know if you remember, but they have something called comedy cover, where they have actors portray other actors doing comics, like classic comics. So I forget who it was, but they were doing Al with the night he died. They had an actor doing Al Pacino, mimicking a story of George Carlin's talking about baseball. The game of baseball, in an Al Pacino voice. So that stuff intrigues me.
I'm gonna have to check that out now. Actually, I had never heard of that before. So all of this really, swirls together to create sort of like a blend. This beautiful sort of combination of interests, expressions, impact for you. You mentioned earlier that about a decade ago or so, you personally landed in a dark place and really, I think, had to revisit, how do I be of service to daily clients as they show up, but now that I'm the client, the patient, now that I'm in this space, how do I emerge from that? And it sounds like that was around the time that also the foundation, the early work around what you've now come to call learned hopefulness, really begins to emerge.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of the things that I've noticed as a pattern in my life that I wouldn't have known was a pattern, because I think when you're living it, it's just the next damn thing that comes up. You're not really preparing yourself in such a way. But just like I started before talking about, I'm really not going to be a tradesman. I don't have that skill. I don't think that way, that kind of thing. And sort of having a door shut on you, and then somehow a little squeak opens up. Okay, well, you're going to go do this now. And then this little tiny, fragment of light says, oh, come over in this direction. Then you get there, and maybe that isn't what you thought it would be. But it opens up yet another door. So I've learned to know it's important to honor the pain, that it's there, and it's probably a lesson of some kind for you to cope with. And, on the furthest end of the extreme of that kind of discomfort is, is there something about me being able to tolerate this that's important to learn? Is this something that I have to end my experience with and move on? Or does this start a quest for me looking for a better way? So it's taking a deep sense of honoring pain as a teacher, and then a motivator, and then just like a rocket ship would have a booster rocket that falls away, it gives a boost, and then once you get away from the Earth's gravity, something else pulls you. That's been my experience, that I'm often motivated by profound discomfort, and this discomfort then ignites a spark that has to be dealt with in one way, shape, or form. And then, you know, as you collect more and more of these experiences, you learn, do I stay too long in uncomfortable situations? Probably. But it's also helped me gain tremendous tolerance for other people's pain. So, you know, it's like, it's not always all bad, all good, but you develop a way of thinking about it that can be very helpful to move you along to the next step.
Yeah. I mean, I'm familiar with the concept of learned helplessness. Hope is interesting. Learned hopefulness, and the fact that it actually to be able to think about, okay, so you started from a place of darkness, your own struggle that launched you into this deeper exploration, which, you know, years over the process of years built into theory and practice and tools to work towards this thing called learned hopefulness. What are we actually talking about here? What is this thing?
Yeah, so I was just very lucky. I went to, UPenn and the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology, and, you know, was a student. And literally the day that I graduated, the next day, Marty Seligman invited me to become his assistant. So I've been in that role for about 10 years. And the glorious part of that was, we got every year now, every semester I was exposed to the latest, hottest, newest research, all the best folks in the field coming to speak at UPenn, and, being able to talk with Marty about a wide variety of things. And then about 3 or 4 years ago now, I was invited to a lecture that he was giving with Steve Mayer. And this lecture was a 50-year follow-up. Imagine that these two guys were roommates at Penn back in the day. They did this incredible research on helplessness. It explodes, changes the world of psychology. And basically, those original experiments were animals and then humans. They would put them in an uncomfortable situation, an aversive situation. And in this situation, they were exposing them to chronic adverse situations where they couldn't get out of them. No matter what they did, they were just stuck. So it was all kinds of situations. But basically, if it went on for a while, you would see the animals get really agitated in the beginning. Then they would just basically give up and they would collapse. And then they would put them later on in a situation where it should be very easy for them. You know, they would put them in a cage where this floor would get electrified and they would jump over this very low partition. They should be able to escape it. It's called an escape paradigm that they use. But what happened is when they were exposed to something that unpleasant, they gave up instantly. They wouldn't do anything. They would just cry and whimper and lay down and stay in a bad place. So here we have this incredible paradigm that blew everybody away, because it showed that if you had this kind of learning where nothing you did mattered in this situation, that it would transfer over to future situations and create learned helplessness, right? Marty's book came out in 1975. It blew the world away, changed how we think about depression, because it was about getting control and cha-cha-cha. So I go to this class and 50-year follow-up. Now, back in the 60s and early 70s, when they were doing this, they didn't have fMRIs. They didn't know what was going on in the brain. They had to make guesses about all this. Well, now they know. And what they realized is that they were completely wrong about the theory. I had read the paper, but listening to them, here are two of these extraordinary researchers, made an incredible career, changed the world. Said, nah, we're wrong. So it's one thing if somebody else challenges your theory, but when you're so dedicated to truth that you say, yeah, we didn't know this back then, but here's what's happening. And they created this situation where they were able to watch what happens in the brain when you're exposed to something aversive, and it's aversive and it's chronic. And what happens is there's literally like a switch in your brain that shuts you down. It's just like my laptop here or my cell phone. If it gets overheated, it's going to shut down to preserve itself. It's like, no, the conditions here are not good. Let's not waste our energy. We're built for survival. So if we're in a crummy situation for a long enough period of time, we're going to shut down. But now the intriguing part is, when you're in another situation, what are you going to do? Well, you're not unlearning something, because nothing was learned in the first paradigm. It was really an evolutionary response, right? So now you're in a new situation. And in this new situation, it's risk assessment of the future. So the example I can give you is, like, if I'm about to cross the street, right? And I start to cross the street and I get clipped by a green car and it breaks my leg. They take me to the hospital. I'm in there for a couple of weeks. When I come out and I go to cross the street, I am going to be a little bit, you know, wondering, what can I do? What can I do? If I find myself right back at the same corner I was where I got hurt, there's nothing about the past that I have to unlearn. I'm going to start making a risk assessment of, can I get to the other side of this street now in this moment? Are there any cars coming now? The risk assessment is a prospection. It's the future. It's not about the past. The past might inform it, but what's going to pull me forward is if I can make an assessment about the future and then believe I have control over it. And they called this this loop in the brain that shuts off and turns back on, the hope circuit. I remember them saying it and I almost bolted out of my seat. It's like, sorry, I have to go write this book. I mean, you know, so that was the origin of it. That was the inspiration. And then I just reviewed all the research on hope and all the theories. And I found they were all like the blind man holding the elephant. You know, the one guy grabs the tail and says, oh, hope looks like a rope. The other guy grabs the leg and says, it looks like a tree. The other guy grabs the ear and says, oh, it looks like a bird. And I said, well, instead of me challenging all these theories, what if they're all right, but they just have different pieces of it? What would hope look like if what we know from medicine and we know from social psychology and we know from educational psychology and character development, and personality, what if they were all right? What would hope look like? And then that's where learned hopefulness came from.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the integration of all these different worlds, but also the underlying, the awakening that it's not a process of unlearning and relearning. It's really a process of activating to a certain extent. And also that it is an intentional thing. Mm. You know, like, there are decisions that you can make, there are tools that you can use, and there are actions that you can take to go from a place of having, you know, like, feeling like you've given up to actually a very different place, which is interesting too, because, you know, if we think about, you know, in a clinical setting, so many people who are living with depression, and one of the huge overlays with that is this feeling that this will never end. Like, this is in fact the way I'm going to feel forever. Mm-hmm. There's a vanishing of hope from that experience. So if the idea that you could potentially do things that would reactivate hope, which isn't going to cure you immediately, but maybe that's the thing that allows you to start to see a sense of possibility in that setting. And then, you know, that's super powerful. And then I guess my broader curiosity too is, you know, we as a society, as we have this conversation, we are living through a moment, you know, we have layers of things that are both happening now on a public health level, and that have been going on for generations and generations and generations on a systemic oppression level. And I wonder how this reframe works in the context of those bigger things too. So like, my curiosity spans, you know, the immediate experience of somebody who is in some way suffering to this much broader experience of, like, is this involved in some way reshaping larger change at scale?
Yeah, boy, there's a lot there. That's like a 15-layer question there. Right. So, but let me just start at the core. You used a great word about intention. And I think if we can just hold on to that for a moment, because if we try to understand the origin of someone's intention, it kind of pulls back this veil of a belief system, right? And because the intention is really based on a belief. And everything we know in psychology that has to do with well-being or devastation has to do with belief systems. And so it was William James who said, my experience is what I agree to attend to. So now it's like we have lots of possibilities about what we're going to believe, right? But the question becomes, what are we going to pay attention to? This is sort of like, where am I going to shine my light? You know, if I walk into a dark room and I shine the light on the floor and I see mouse droppings and bugs and things like that, my interpretation of the entire room is that it's infested and bad and negative, right? But if I take that same light and I shine it on the wall and there's a marvelous, marvelous work of art, a Monet or Rembrandt, and oh my goodness, that's what this room is holding. So the question becomes, how do we do what I call belief modification? You know, in the 60s, we had behavior modification. It's like belief modifications at the core of this. And our beliefs are, they're so central to our health, well-being, politics, social development. They're so central to it that we can not see the forest for the trees kind of thing. If you take a look at something like medicine, right, and a new drug. Well, what do the pharmaceutical companies have to go up against in order to prove that this medicine is good or important or valuable? Well, they have to go up against our belief system. They have to go up against the placebo effect, right? And what is the placebo effect? It's people believing that something has property to it. It has, so the belief system in a placebo is that there's something good that's going to happen here. And in a nocebo effect, which is the opposite of that, it's like something bad. And if you've ever gotten a new drug or medicine or something like that, you Google it and you read the side effects, you're going to get all those side effects. So part of it is to help people recognize that they have a choice. And that not to make a decision to change is a decision to remain the same. Either way, there's an incipient moment that we can either repeat or we can challenge. And bringing that core awareness to people's attention is really what learned hopefulness is about, to recognize when you're making a decision to do things the way they were being done, that's a choice. And something that can change. And, you know, a lot of the different exercises and things that are introduced there are about helping people challenge their perceptions so that change is possible.
Yeah, I mean, you also make a really interesting distinction between hope and faith, which I thought was mm-hmm. fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, people use hope, optimism, and faith in the same breath, that like they're all the same. And while I understand it, and I've certainly done that myself over the years, I had to learn the nuances. So there's with hope, you're saying that I believe I can influence the future. I can have an effect on that. I can control it. I can do something about the future. I can make something happen. That's very different than optimism, where you are just under the belief that something good's going to happen tomorrow. I think it's going to work out. There's no sense of agency there. There's no sense of, you know, personal pathway that you can make something happen. It's that something good. It's more generic. Faith has to do with letting go of what it is that you can control, and that there are outside forces that are going to manage the outcome, not you. You're going to have power and control up to a point, and then something else. It could be a government. It could be a higher power. It could be other people. It could be your parents. You know, it depends on where you are and what format that is. But at some point, you have to recognize that what you can control is no longer going to influence the future. Something else will. You know, there was a great interview back in the day for Catfish Hunter. He was a pitcher into the Hall of Fame, and he talked about all of his training. And he talked, oh, you know, how he took care of his arm and worked out in the off season and this and that, and, you know, practice in different weather and, you know, in the rain and this and that, so that he would be prepared. And I remember listening to this interview, and he said, but at some point, I've got to let go of that ball. And then I don't have any more control. So I want to bring as much control to that moment as possible. Then I have to let it go. And I thought, oh, man, what a wonderful metaphor for life.
Yeah. Kind of like the Serenity Prayer to a certain extent.
Very, very true. Right. Very, very true. Right. That's why that prayer's been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It's interesting to me also, you know, one of the things I learned is, you know, sort of exploring, well, life satisfaction, and is this sense of intentionality, a sense of agency, and you know, the phrase locus of control, you know, like we tend to do better, to flourish more, to thrive when we feel like that we have some ability to exert control over the outcome that we seek to achieve. And yet, you know, other data shows that when you look at communities of faith,
yes,
they very often register amongst the highest in terms of being satisfied, mm-hmm. And content with their lives. And they have probably also the highest amount of a certain surrender of a sense of locus of control, and just, you know, really leaning much more towards the faith side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that you sort of like have those two things going on simultaneously.
You know, it's really been interesting, and something has just happened that I'll just share, where I've been invited to become the academic director for the Spirituality Mind-Body Institute at Columbia. So I've been teaching there pretty much right from the beginning, and they invited me to come and you know, sort of help move that program out into the community and offer workshops and that kind of thing. So that's been really lovely, but it's also given me pause for thought about this blend between positive psychology and faith and religion and, you know, all of this kind of stuff, because I'm in a position now where I'm working with religious leaders and spiritual leaders and like that. And along the way, they invited me to speak at St. Patrick's Cathedral, which blew my mind. It was like, holy mackerel.
Which, for those non-New Yorkers, this is this legendary, legendary place in the middle of Manhattan.
And it was, I remember walking in and thinking, oh my goodness, you know, I wish my mom was alive now. I don't know that, you know, and I think even my father would have said, yeah, you know, you didn't become an electrician, but at least you're speaking at this place. So that was really intriguing. And they had invited me in to talk about the difference between hope and faith. And I think one of the things that I really wanted to share during that presentation was this idea that there's a sort of a handshake between the two, that you have to be doing your part. Hope is a matter of staying engaged and being able to achieve your goals, have purpose, you know, move forward, and at the same time recognize that it's like faith holding its hand out to you. That once you can show that you're moving in the right direction and you can feel that, that's basically an extension of saying you're doing the right thing, not just for you, but for the greater good. And that to me is probably the next area I'll take a look at, this idea of how hope and faith intersect.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a fascinating interplay. One of the things that I think is really interesting also in the sort of the exploration of hope, I know that you've referenced numerous times, is that hope, and tell me if I'm getting this right, hope actually requires uncertainty, which is a little counterintuitive, but then when you go deeper, you're like, oh, no, I think I understand that. But it's almost like a prerequisite to hope. Tell me more.
Sure. I think, you know, when you start to study positive psychology and positive emotions, it's sort of like, woohoo, you know, it's like, oh, okay, we're going to figure out about how to have more joy in your life, more happiness in your life. But the thing that really piqued my interest was that hope is the only positive emotion that requires negativity or uncertainty to be activated. See, if I'm not uncertain or negative, I don't need hope. If I am sure of what's about to come and I'm okay with it and I'm, I don't need hope because that's not even on the table. But the uncertainty or negativity is an activator. And once you have that degree of activation, that becomes this incipient moment, this moment of choice. What are you going to do with this uncertainty or negativity? You know, in Mandarin, there's a symbol for crisis is opportunity and danger. And I took a deeper look at where that came from. And really what it means is there's a moment here of choice that you have to make. What is it are you going to do when you're confronted with this negativity or this uncertainty? And that choice point is a decision. You're either going to decide to see this as an opportunity and a challenge and move toward it, or you're going to collapse under the weight of it. And that's that fulcrum point between learned hopefulness and learned helplessness. It's like, I'm going to shut down from this, because I don't think I can have any effect. Or I'm going to start recalibrating my goals. I'm going to start seeing this as a challenge. What can I do to bring about a change? And that spot ends up being, to me, super, super fascinating. Super fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, doesn't it in a way also circle back to that original, using your language, the fulcrum between comedy and tragedy?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I feel like I'm just sort of haptically going through life, sort of feeling my way, you know. It's like, oh, wow, there's a pattern here, you know. You know, and I don't think it's, if I take a look at the larger thing, I was a trauma expert, now a positive psychologist. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess it's, you know, but there's a great saying in Buddhism, you know, you pick up one end of a stick, you pick up the other. I don't talk about positive psychology now without talking about the difficulties, and I don't talk about trauma without talking about the hope that comes with it. So I think that's a very astute observation on your part.
Yeah, one of the other things that that you explore and you write about your most recent work is this idea of the role of noticing beauty, noticing blessings,
right,
and how we tend to arrive at whatever moment we're in our lives, wired through experience and whatever it is that brings us to that moment, with often profoundly different noticing skills, like the things that we actually see. And I guess it, speaks to what you were talking about before also, to a certain extent. You look down and then you look against the wall. But I think my curiosity around this also is that I wonder if we don't realize that those around us, even those closest to us, who we feel we know best in the world, may be wired profoundly differently, and we almost don't understand how they could not see things the way we see them.
Yes. Yeah. You know, in some of the things like we talked about a little earlier with the virtual gratitude visit, this idea of embodied cognition, at its core is a role reversal. That means to try and understand what it is that other people are experiencing. There's a really deep ignorance for most of us, myself included, about what's going on with the other person. Most of the therapy that I do and most of the work that I do now is about trying to understand what is that person's experience. I don't have to agree with it. I don't have to, you know, sanction it. But I'm not going to be helpful or effective or informed unless I can fully take that perspective. That was one of the things that Moreno really, really helped to illuminate, this idea. It's not just about encountering the other person. It's about becoming the other person, being the other person for a while so that you understand it experientially. Then when you come back to being you, you're transformed. You're awakened in a way that you can't do cognitively. If I just say, yeah, I know what your experience is like. No. But if I have a little taste of it, a little bit of that reality, now I have, oh, that's an affective learning experience. Now I get it. Now I understand it. And I think that's been very much missing in education, very much missing in university work, because there's a lot of education that's done academically, which is certainly needed. But I'm of the mind that's good. Let's put it into an experience where people can feel what it feels like, just even if it's for a moment, because now that's going to inform your awareness in a very different way.
Yeah, and that makes so much sense to me. How powerful would it be if that was actually something that was built into every college-age student's experience in a meaningful way, some sort of, you know, like guided, intelligently well-formed experience that lets you do that. And maybe with, you know, a range of people who you saw both as being very similar to you and also radically different to you. And then, you know, being able to go through a process, you know, like, okay, so let's take a semester and every week we're going to like pick, you know, different people. I can't even begin to imagine how people would be changed by an experience like that.
Absolutely. I'll just share two projects that I'm immersed in now that are along these lines. I'll talk about the first one. Second memoir was called American Snake Pit, Hope, Grit, and Resilience in the Wake of Willowbrook. And what I wanted to do there was tell the stories of transformation that people who, you know, on the average had IQs around 40, had a secondary psychiatric disorder, and who were in the worst asylum in American history. And they had created an experiment to bring them out into the community only so that it would fail and they would go back in. So spoiler alert, if you haven't read the book, they do much better than anybody thought. And so I wanted to write those stories. And I also did the screenplay for American Snake Pit because I really believe that if people can see exemplars, and this is a social justice book. I mean, I did all the research on the legal background, the Willowbrook Decree and what happened in New York State because of it. It's a lot of people don't know that mental health became a civil right in the United States because of the Willowbrook Decree. In other words, they couldn't put anybody in any institution, in a prison, in a nursing home, any institution, without having mental health rights. That's where that came from. And you know, we can talk about the legal stuff, and you've been through enough of the legal things to know that that can be pretty tedious and difficult. But can we tell a story, and can we show a video? Can we show a movie that awakens people's spirit and ignites their own transformational properties? Because that, to me, is a way of reversing roles too. I might not have had their life, but if I can see a movie, and if it's done well enough, if that story is told well enough, I am going to resonate with that story in a way that's going to awaken my story. And now we've got something that's very powerful, because you can't watch something like that and not be moved and not be transformed. And that's where I think we have great movies that give you a little glimpse into the life of another person. That storytelling, that I'm really interested in, because we might not always be able to reverse roles, but if the story is well done, movie is well done, you're going to be able to live in that space for a little while and then come on out with an informed opinion. And the second thing I'll mention is we're taking the elements of the virtual gratitude visit. I'm working with people from the Actors Studio to take the experiential theater to another level, where we can set it up properly so that people could have a theatrical experience, an engagement with someone else's real world authentic drama in a very brief period of time, but they'll be moved by it and inspired to do their own work. So I think there are ways, my point about them is that there are ways through storytelling and theater that can help us reverse roles with others. Even if we can't live their life, we can understand it at a deep level.
Yeah, so agree. I hadn't even really thought of theater as that, but for sure the most profound theater that I've seen does that to me. I mean, what's the name of the show? The dog.
Curious Incident.
Curious Case of the Dog. You know, this is you know, effectively a one person or just a couple of, you know, like people, and somebody whose life experience was radically different than mine, and yet the whole time I left changed.
Sure.
You know, it was just it was super powerful. The one other thing that sort of surfaced for me looking through certainly your work on hopefulness also is the role of expectation.
Yes.
Which I think is kind of fascinating.
Yes.
And how that really has a strong effect.
Absolutely. I you know, in doing the research for Learned Hopefulness, I went back and I looked at the studies in hypnosis back in the 60s, and there was some extraordinary stuff. It's carried forward, but in one series of studies, they had hypnotized people and told them that they're doing this experiment on pain thresholds and blah, 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 and that they were going to touch them with a very hot coal. And that, you know, they're not going to break the skin, but they're, you know, they're going to be touched with this hot coal. And they get them ready. They put them in this trance, right? And then they touch them with an ice cube. And what happens is they blister up. So you start to think about that for a minute. It was like, oh, my goodness. Now we have all other kinds of studies where the expectation itself transforms us biochemically. So they have studies on allergens where they say, oh, this is indeed ragweed. It's not, you know, and they say, you're going to get this, and vice versa. They'll take something that has the active allergen and tell people that it's not this. Oh, okay, yeah, I don't get the symptoms. The power of expectation peels back to the power of belief. If you believe, you know, it comes back to Henry Ford, right? Believe you can, believe you can't, either way you'll be right.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, because I think people could probably make the leap between, okay, so my expectation about how something will unfold, I can see how that would track back to me even less than consciously changing my behavior so that I'm more likely to play an active role in making it unfold a particular way or not.
Right.
But the notion that simply the expectation of a certain experience or outcome will actually potentially change our biochemistry, our physiology, is both freaky and cool.
Do we have time for a quick experiment? It won't take long, so I'll just ask people, as long as you're not driving a car or something like that, to close your eyes for a moment. And I'd like you to imagine a lemon that is in front of you on the table. And as you see the lemon, you become aware that there's a very slight wisp of a smell of lemon in the air. Now I'd like you to imagine cutting that lemon in half. And as you do, you'll see little bits of lemon juice come on out. And the smell of lemon actually gets a little bit stronger. And if you pick up half of that lemon, I'd like you to put it right under your nose. Take that half of lemon and really take in a deeper smell of it right now. And if you would, I'd like you to just bite right into that half a lemon. Grind your teeth into it. Bite right into it. And if you'd open your eyes, my guess is you produce saliva. If you bit into that imaginary lemon and produce saliva, you've changed your biochemistry just by imagining this. There's no lemon, there's no smell. You just allowed yourself to focus on that, and it changed your biochemistry. Can you imagine what happens when we're having ruminating negative thoughts? It's generating almost pure cortisol. Our adrenals are pumping all of this biochemistry through us because we're worried constantly about it. So it's like we're chewing on lemons 24/7 when we're ruminating. And by the way, I'll just tell you the flip side of this. Normally when I do this, I have people imagine somebody they love. And that person is right in front of them, and they get a warm feeling in their chest. And I had a student last semester said, "So it's really about lemons or lovers." I was like, "Yeah, kind of. That's it. That's pretty much."
Yeah, I'm just so fascinated by the sort of like seamless feedback loop between our state of mind and our state of physiology, mm-hmm. And how that can then manifest mm-hmm. in everything from hope to depression to illness to positive outcomes and actions in our lives. And even, like things, I'm fascinated by how, we're so unaware of the link between so many things. I remember reading research that showed that people who were holding a cup that was either filled with cold water or a warm beverage and then introduced to somebody new, we're far more likely to have warm feelings, to like the person if they were holding a warm beverage.
Absolutely.
And to feel that the person was cold and distant if they were holding a cold glass of water. And we're like, are we really that sort of like simple?
Yeah.
Apparently we are.
Yeah. There's so many different levels of studies on perception and how it influences us. And some of it like that, some of it visual. That's the other thing I'll just say about the news. I've been a very strong advocate for people to limit their news watching, because if you're bombarded with negativity, there's a saying in the news, if it bleeds, it leads, right? So if you sit down and are listening to the negativity, watching the images from that without a cap on it, one of the things that will happen, just like you said, if we could be influenced by the temperature of water and our interaction with others, what happens if we're exposed to, I belong to the media group for psychologists, in Division 46 at the APA. And, we say every year, don't show the images of 9/11. You re-traumatize folks. Well, the truth is a lot of the material that's out there can be re-traumatizing. And if you keep it to about 15 minutes a day, tops, you get all the news you need. You get everything. You'll get updates. And probably if you read it, it's a little better than being in front of the imagery. Because the imagery then influences us another way. I'm not asking you to not be informed, but to manage your stimulus activation of that, because you can stay informed, but not overwhelm yourself.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Starting to zoom out a little bit as we start to bring our conversation closer to an end. And I want to zoom the lens out again to what we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, which is these ideas, and maybe even this idea of expectation in the context of the moment that we're in, where, you know, I've had fascinating conversations lately with people who, honestly, for decades or generations, have looked at the state of our culture, of society, of race, of all these different things that are playing into it, and done the work, and yet at the same time said, they simultaneously don't really have any hope of change. And what the conversations with some of those same people very recently has changed, not that they believe that we are going to see large-scale change, but there's this slightest glimmer that hope has entered the building.
Yes, right.
And that there's not even an expectation that things will change, but there's this expectation that maybe they won't stay the same. Mm. And I'm just curious about how that plays into our experience of the moment.
Well, you know, when I have this thing called a 21-day hope challenge that is based on a host of interventions, most of which are in the book. But the idea about it is that there are 7 for the past, 7 for the present, and 7 for the future. And a lot of people don't think about positive psychology in terms of like interventions. They just think, what can I do to feel better? But when you break it down, there are things from our past that can be extremely helpful for us to go back and reharvest. So the gratitude we have for what happened yesterday, that's very specific. Just thinking about that again changes our chemistry in the moment. It elongates that positivity and brings that forward. And things like unforgiveness. So people have a pain from the past, and if they hold on to it, it sort of becomes an inhibitor. So there's like 7 of those I've developed that you go back and you can either activate and extend a positive emotion and bring it more into the present, or you can release something that's been an inhibitor. When we get to the present, there's a host of things that can happen there, something called dispositional mindfulness, flow, things that bring us right into the moment. But the number one thing is kindness. See, kindness has got this big bang for the buck. I remember Marty Seligman being asked at a conference, you know everything about depression. What's the fastest way to get out of a depression? He never missed a beat. He said, do something kind for someone else. This idea that kindness can change not only our internal focus, but our external interaction is really powerful, because an act of kindness, it comes with it something called elevation. Elevation is a phenomenon in positive psychology where we seem to be wired for noticing the good stuff. But it's sort of latent because we're overwired for the bad stuff. Right? We're sort of, if you see a woman helping a man cross the street because he's elderly, you'll notice that and feel this warm feeling. But if there's a guy yelling at a cop because he just got a parking ticket and his voice is escalating and getting closer to the cop, and you see that, that's going to hijack your attention because it's a threat. With kindness, if we engage in an act of kindness, we're going to feel good. The person receiving it's going to feel good. But the big bang for the buck is that anybody witnessing it will feel just about as good, have just as much change in their vagal tone and biochemistry as the people engaged in it. So the one thing that you can do is be kind. And there's actually a protocol that I write about that it's a 5 acts of kindness in one day. And you pick one day a week. My day is Thursday. So, you know, this means if you drop the book on Wednesday, I'll say, I wish I could help you, but no. It's that I just become very focused on that day. You do 5 acts of kindness in that one day. And what happens is it elevates your awareness to kindness around you. You start noticing it more and it kind of pulls you out of your own dark space.
Mm. Yeah, love that. So it feels like a good place for us to come full circle as well. So hanging out together in this container of the Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To the quote I used earlier by William James, my experience is what I agree to attend to. And for a good life, attend to the things that you want to see happen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.